Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Trail of Tears. When I had been a letter carrier for about 8 years, I finally got my own route. It was a maze of rusty gates, rotten stairs, and dogs with names like Blade, Major, King. None of the occupants owned the houses, so nothing ever got fixed. The racial mix was across the map, from Sri Lanka to Portugal, from Cape Town to Newfoundland. Every so often a grow op was busted, a person got stabbed, or a house got shot up in a drive-by. The bushes were thick, the trees were old, and the sidewalks were broken up by ancient roots. I nicknamed it the Trail of Tears. That is, until I got to know it intimately. Then I dubbed it the Widowmaker. This mailman's attitude to his roots is like the attitude he has towards his spouse. She is mine and I cherish her. I held this route for about 7 years. I suffered broken bones and also had life-changing revelations on this route. The houses were old stucco-covered wood-framed affairs with dank basements. The yards all had old gates with several busted concrete steps to an overgrown yard and another set of rotten wooden stairs leading up the front porch. After putting my foot through several rotten front stairs, I asked the occupants to have them fixed. I waited weeks to no avail, so I simply removed the offending planks and tossed them into the front yard, making ingress to the front door impossible. The turnaround time for new stairs was about 2 days. This also worked for front gates, long rusted shut and hung from fences with posts rotted at the soil line. One of these gates could squander several hundred calories by itself, leaving one weak to deal with the other obstacles of the day. Snapping the post off with well-placed kicks and laying the whole affair flat in the lawn was satisfying, easy to walk over, and the turnaround time to a new fence was about a week. No paperwork was involved, necessary, nor was language a barrier. The frustrations were ubiquitous and the hazards were many and very real. The people were the lower middle class workers and the welfare recipients. Some had been children of the first wave of immigrants and were determined to succeed after watching their parents' Herculean efforts come to naught. Some of these turned to the easy money offered by crime. There were pimps, dealers, gangsters of every stripe, illegal aliens, junkies, alcoholics, and schizophrenics. Every day was a brand new adventure. As they come to mind, I will tell some of these adventures on the Trail of Tears. The territory is Vancouver's east side in the decade of the 90s. The stories are true and I only omit enough details to protect those still living in the hood. Don't let my choice of names for this collection of stories give the impression that all was negative. Far from it. There were moments of perfect bliss, Satori, Shibumi, and enlightenment. I'm Michael Hawes, and you're listening to Trail of Tears. Peering into the Abyss. Over the years, I had many routes, and as the time progressed, the Board of Canada Post put into practice all the ideas that were hatched at their meetings. Small neighborhood stations began to amalgamate and coalesce into ever larger operations housed in new buildings. It was a real estate sell-off and a preparation for downsizing that required no PhD to interpret. I found myself working for a newly created station, which was a combination of two stations which had been my learning ground in my early days. There was a contest to name the new station, and after the rejection of Stalag 31 and other such names, it was decided that the winning name was to be Mountain View. The new letter carrier station was situated on Yukon Street in Vancouver at 7th Avenue. It was divided into two floors, with the upstairs being the old Depot 31 and the downstairs being the old Station C. The latter station's territory was the east side, and the upstairs covered the west up to Oak Street. The upstairs routes encompassed all the larger apartment towers and higher income residential areas, thus the dogs were smaller and much friendlier. It occurred to a friend, an early mentor of mine within the post office, that it was time for the two of us to move on up to the west side. His plan was for us to grab two monster apartment walks and cash in on the lack of gates and stairs, as well as all the extra money for the delivery of metric tons of junk mail. I considered his plan and concurred. My family was without wheels, and the car commercials kept telling me that I belonged outdoors bungee jumping with my brood. We were regularly hiking and pursuing all kinds of activities, but we had to come and go by bus. It was getting to be a drag. We both placed our bids and were both successful. My route was just under 900 calls, and my friend's was in the same ballpark. Before a quarter was up, my friend bit off to do something more humane, and I stubbornly stayed on my route, making one after-tax cent per flyer until I had saved enough to buy a vehicle with the cash saved over the course of 4 years or so. During this time, I was successful in tearing both menisci. My knees swelled up to the size of grapefruits and stayed that way for 2 years while I awaited my turn to get an MRI to diagnose the problem. Meanwhile, I altered my sortation case on the weekend, fixing it so my histamine holders wouldn't bang into the unforgiving maple. I was on that route for 4 years before a successful bid took me to a residential route, which, although many times longer to walk, proved to be better for my knees. During the 4 years, I was busy climbing all the peaks in North Vancouver's Lynn watershed on my time off. All the same time, I was studying up on tracking and generally trying to become more tuned in to my surroundings in the bush. As I progressed in this endeavor, I began to see more wildlife each time. In addition, I had learned to monitor the weather, the route, and my own condition. I began to notice many more things, even at home in my own neighborhood, as well as at work on my route. The city is just another jungle and has its own food chain. I noticed for the first time the man across the street who had visits from prostitutes about twice a month. I noticed the ever-changing bagmen who carried off the day's drug-selling proceeds to their boss from an apartment several blocks to the south. Before, they had just blended in as random passers-by. Now, it was as if they and their two bodyguards across the street were spray-painted with day-glow orange. They passed by around 8 p.m. each evening and made the drop at the Chevron station on the corner. The bodyguards changed each time, as did the bagman. The method and the timing was rock solid, and you could set your watch to it. Looking back, it may have also been the constant severe pain in my knees that contributed to my extra heightened awareness at this time. I noticed a man one day standing by the upraised hood of his car while I was delivering my route. When I glanced at him, I knew he was out of place, and when I left that street nearly an hour later, he hadn't budged. He stood in exactly the same spot, hands on the hood, and seemed to peer into the depths of his engine. I knew a customer, a Welshman, who was a private detective. We discussed the man I had seen, and I was told that in a city the size of Vancouver, in a neighborhood as high-end and as dense as was my route, there would easily be dozens of his ilk, busy doing jobs for suspicious wives, husbands, bosses, and insurance personnel. Added to this were the throngs of camera carriers. Some were students, and some worked for real estate companies, and others were tourists. This new information made me even more aware of my surroundings. It became a new adventure each day as I spotted all the snoopers. They had always been there, I had just been oblivious before. Now it was easy to see who was out of context. Part of the secret of seeing them has to do with movement. In a cityscape, people are in constant flow, both the observer and the observed. If a person drives slowly past a man peering into the hood of his car at the roadside, the person makes a mental note that they are glad it isn't their car in trouble and then shift their attention to that lady in red sashaying over to a car parked in front of a flower shop. The vision of the man will be forgotten in an instant, and the observer's mind will already have written a backstory and a conclusion to the whole phenomena. If, however, the observer happened along that way again 4 hours later, and the same man hadn't moved an inch, he would begin for the first time to analyze that man. If the observer had himself stopped within sight of the car man for even 45 minutes, he would have then become intrigued. This propensity of the human mind to fill in blanks to the satisfaction of the observer in order to avoid processing any extra data is greatly heightened by city life. People that would fool you are well versed in their understanding of this trait, and they use it to their advantage. I began to relate my day's sightings to my Welsh PI friend, and he laughed each time I mentioned a ruse that he himself had used in his work. I found every CCT camera on my route, and I noticed for the first time that the bus I rode to work was wired for both sight and sound. I noticed that the photography supply store on my route was a front for selling hydroponic grow operation chemicals out the back door. I found 3 in-home meth labs and 2 in-home grow operations. I noticed that a travel agency on my route had never been in business for the entire 4 years I delivered its mail. As it wasn't a lump of 900 calls, it was a while before I noticed that the jacket slung over the chair at the desk and the empty coffee mug adjacent hadn't moved a centimeter. Only the pile of mail under the front door slot had been picked up about once a week. I noticed one day while sorting mail that I was receiving about 500 missorted letters that were for another colleague's route. They were addressed to a private post office box service about 2 blocks away from the bogus travel agency. It became annoying to cull this mail out and walk across the station to give it to the other carrier. On one of these trips to dump that morning's gleanings, I noticed that the other carrier was delivering about 50 pounds of this mail per day to that box. I saw Dayglow Orange. I scrutinized the envelopes and I noticed that all the letters were from Alabama, Georgia, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, and Mississippi. Most were scrawled in pencil and the towns of origin were all tiny rural communities. Eventually, in the flood, came one letter that hadn't been sealed and the contents fell out of its nearly destroyed envelope. It was a cheaply printed note telling the sender that they had won very much money, and as soon as their $5 cash processing fee was received, they would be sent the information as to how to collect their windfall. Folded inside the note was a wrinkled, crinkled, wadded $5 bill. It was covered in the dust and dirt of honest toil, and I could imagine the sharecropper sitting at his or her kitchen table, making it ready to send, and dreaming of perhaps a new roof for his shack. I replaced the contents and sent it on its evil way. I was angry, and I googled up the codes on the exterior of the envelope and found that the source for sending out the winner's notices was a self-serve postal outlet in a small mall in South Carolina. One weekend, I sat sipping coffee and munching pizza next to the P.O. Box business in Vancouver and watched 2 nice-looking young men haul away a massive sack of these envelopes into their expensive car. I did a rough calculation and found that these bandits were making some serious money. I told my boss, and with a raised eyebrow, she informed me that Canada Post's security and investigation team was hot on the trail already. She seemed surprised that I had noticed anything at all. She gave me a card with a number to phone if I saw anything else pertinent. Not long after this, it was my turn. They say if you peer too long into the abyss, it will begin to look back at you. I became aware one fine day that I was being followed and monitored. It was obvious to me, and nothing would have looked out of place to anyone else. It was being done by a team, and a fairly large one. No one stalker stayed on me for long without being replaced by another. The playground was my route, and the duration was several months. These people were mostly in their 30s and had some sophisticated equipment for the time I'm speaking of. Some of their methods were classic and could have been found in any police training manual or any good spy novel. I was even photographed by a young man once with a peephole camera that he had installed in the left elbow of his army surplus jacket. The jacket was spotlessly clean and his shoes were far too expensive for my postie salary. In the elbow of the jacket there was a neatly cut circular hole the size of a match head, and the man awkwardly pressed a squeeze-type shutter mechanism with his right hand while cutting in front of me on the sidewalk and pointing his elbow at me like a gun. I asked him if he wanted to take 2 in case it didn't come out well as he sped off around the first corner. My first instinct in these days was that it's not really happening. This was disproved very quickly. My second instinct was that it was the post office training a new crop of security and investigation people. This was logical, as my route was close to the station, close to transportation from downtown, and had many good places to eat and buy coffee. I approached my superintendent and asked him if this was the case, or if I was actually being shadowed due to the large amount of overtime which I had legitimately booked on my monster route. He answered that he himself was not aware of any investigation of myself, and had not ordered such. He said he would phone the appropriate high-ups and make sure. The next day, he told me that Canada Post was definitely not involved. That tore it for me. It wasn't fun anymore. I was being hunted, and I didn't know why or by whom. The surveillance would start within a block of my exit from the station. I always walked from 7th and Canby up the steep hill to 16th. Usually a man or woman would emerge from either a parked car or a doorway across the busy boulevard. They would be in lockstep with me, and if I altered my pace, they did likewise. If I crossed the street, they would abruptly break off and either enter a store or turn a corner. Within seconds, I could always pick up the next tracker who would emerge from a store or a car or a doorway on either side of the street. They would always give themselves away by matching my purposely changing stride and their sudden dash into a store if I looked too long at them. The sheer number of players along the length and breadth of my territory told me that they were sophisticated and were not after me personally. Rather, they were after my schedule. As these guys took notes outside of each of my big apartment towers as to my arrival time and length of stay, I took license numbers of every vehicle I saw them scurry into throughout the day. I phoned these into S&I each day. I began to vary my delivery sequence at random. This caused much confusion at first, and several times I surprised a spook. Sometimes I would have a smoke in the cover of a big evergreen while watching a perplexed hoodlum check his watch and anxiously looking in the direction I was supposed to come from. These moments made the pressure more bearable. One afternoon, I was followed to my rented duplex. I had a wife and two sons in there, and now things were taking a serious turn. That weekend, I saw one of the crew seemingly standing right across my street at a bus stop. He let bus after bus go by. I told my wife. She said, "Pop, you're working too hard." I told her I would make a prediction. I told her to watch the man let two buses go by from our window first. Then I told her that as soon as I stepped out into the yard, he would magically decide to take that very next bus. My wife smiled and took up my challenge. Turned out I was right. I had my payback for getting cheeky with these guys by the fact that they knew where I lived and some of my family routine. Over the next few weeks, the mail started to be stolen from my route and many adjacent routes in this part of town. At first, the panels of boxes were broken open physically, but within weeks, they were simply opened with some sort of key and reclosed. Piles of mail were discovered dumped in city parks, beaches, and other places, sometimes miles from the source. Each instance was duly reported to the station and to the Security and Investigation Department. I had to phone them daily and sometimes a few times in one day. The operation was very big. I continued randomizing my delivery patterns and observing everything around me. One day, I did a very convoluted pattern of delivery and was treated to the following sight. A young woman, probably in her teens and dressed in dirty torn jeans and a t-shirt, was busy in the lobby of a building that I would normally not get to until many hours later in the afternoon. She had her own key and a black plastic garbage bag. She was nearly finished shoving all the last few letters into the bag and locking up the panels with a practiced hand. As I watched from behind a juniper bush, she headed off down the sidewalk in the direction of a mall on 12th Avenue. Right across the street from her were two young muscle boys who escorted her all the way to the mall. I grinned, as I had arranged the night before to meet my wife and son at the food court of this very same mall. I checked my watch. I decided to arrive at my lunch a bit early and follow the mail thieves. I checked my rear and sides and followed two blocks behind. When the young lady got to the entrance, the young men kept on their way past the mall. I hurried into the food court. I just saw the girl disappear into a corridor which contained the door to the big mail room of the mall and some washrooms. I sat at a good vantage point and awaited my wife. My son and wife called me from across the floor, and soon we were all chowing away on noodles. I didn't mention the drama to my wife so she wouldn't stare, and it gave me an excuse for being in that place at that time in case I was being studied. I never took my eye off the corridor. After about 10 minutes, the young woman appeared, this time all dressed in swanky shoes, a nice dress, and adorned with jewelry and makeup. She streamed into the throng and instantly became just another shopper who had been there all day. I watched the corridor over my wife's head. In about 4 minutes, out came a big man in his early 40s. He was dressed in an expensive, well-fitting suit like a lawyer and had a hands-free phone in his ear. He was gripping a small, expensive Gucci gentleman's bag. As he exited the food court area, he mumbled into his mic and I caught some movement on the mezzanine level above where we were sitting. There, stationed at the four corners, were four goons in their 30s, similarly dressed to the man with the briefcase, all with phones in their ears and all moving down four staircases simultaneously to flank their boss out of the building. I hadn't previously noticed them at all. I had occasion to meet the local head of postal security some months after this and learned that Russian mobsters had worked this scam right across Canada. They were well-funded, well-equipped, well-trained, well-disciplined, and not to be trifled with. They had managed to equip themselves with the keys then in use via armed assaults and always used underage dupes to do the actual theft. The postal keys across Canada were all changed to a vastly superior type in response. The irony that this all happened in the nicer parts of town was a new lesson for me. I learned that poor areas have much visible petty crime and thus an overblown reputation that tars many decent people with a dirty brush. There simply aren't the funds to cover the dirt with. Conversely, nice parts of a town harbor every type of evil, almost perfectly concealed under a layer of store-bought window dressing.